Madam Clerk, can you please call the next case?
324-0722 Warren S. Winkler, LLC, Appellee versus Weld All Incorporated, Appellant.
Okay, Mr. Tumminaro, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Judge.
All right, very well.
Thank you. Judge Attorney Matt Tumminaro on behalf of the appellant in this case. Judge, we filed this appeal to bring two important issues that we have with how the motion to vacate default judgment in this case was decided in the trial court. The two, well, and really, it's two important issues relating to that motion and also the judgment. The first issue is we don't believe that the trial court properly defaulted Weldall, the corporation Weldall Incorporated, when it did enter that default judgment on October 30th, 2024. But also, we don't believe that the timely filed motion to vacate under 1301E was properly decided. As it relates to the default judgment when that was entered, if and we cite to it in our brief, if you look at the transcript, it appears that the trial court defaulted the corporation without having inquired as to any circumstances about why the trial court's order to file defendant's appearance before the trial date wasn't followed. We know that defendant was pro se, although normally you need an attorney to represent a corporation. It is small claims court, so.
Normally,
I was just going to ask. That was an issue that I never saw addressed. No one brought it up, but isn't that a mandatory?
I believe local rules allow, and I don't know if it's the DuPage County local rules or if it's Illinois Supreme Court rules. I believe it is Illinois Supreme Court rules that do allow a pro se owner or president of a company to represent a corporation at only at small claims, and this was a small claims case. So I do believe that he properly could have represented his corporation. I believe he's the only employee of his corporation, but I believe that that is allowed.
Well, Mr. Tumminaro, let's kind of go a little bit further on that then, if I may. So the complaint in this case was verified by the plaintiff's attorney. And did the plaintiff's attorney ever indicate that he had personal knowledge of the facts that were alleged in that complaint? Because I didn't see anywhere in the record where the judge actually inquired by way of a prove-up of the facts when the default was entered that the plaintiff's attorney actually knew any of the facts.
No, Judge, I don't believe that it's, I don't believe that the verification does speak to personal knowledge of those. And it wasn't signed by, it was signed by the attorney, not the client.
That's what I'm saying.
It's,
So did
yes.
anybody ever? Okay.
No, I don't believe so. And unfortunately, I was not in the case until the motion to vacate stage. And so I did not, I didn't have the opportunity to raise any of those issues, because I came in after the default was entered, but no. I don't believe that it was ever verified by someone with personal knowledge. And no, there was no prove up for the default judgment. Default was entered solely on the defendant, my client's failure to file his appearance or his corporation's appearance prior to the trial date that was set on October 30th. And what we believe is in looking at the rules on issuing a default. Obviously, 1301D does allow for a default judgment for failing to file an appearance, but it's discretionary. Discretionary means that, and I guess the definition that I found in Draper versus Kramer says that a court acts arbitrarily without employment of conscious judgment, or if the decision of the court exceeds the bounds of reason and ignores principles of law such that substantial justice has resulted. And I'm not saying that the court acted arbitrarily. I mean, I think the court had a reason to do what it did, but the court didn't inquire as to why or under what circumstances. I think my client being pro se didn't know what a court order was. He didn't know what an appearance was. He should have hired an attorney earlier. And but he did not. He thought, you know, he would be able to handle it because it was small claims court. Hiring an attorney can be an expensive endeavor in small claims court where it can't exceed $10,000. So it's not the best reason in the world why he didn't hire an attorney, but and you know his ignorance of the process is what led to the default in the first place. But the judge, the trial court didn't inquire or ask any questions. The court went right to the order and said, "Well, the appearance isn't here, so enter default judgment for the plaintiff." And we don't believe that, we believe that was an abuse of the trial court's discretion to enter a
Also, I
judgment.
want to ask you about that. So as far as I can tell, your notice of appeal may have been premature. It was filed when there was a still pending motion to reconsider, and you filed the notice of appeal the same day that the judge had a briefing schedule on that motion. And then it looks to me as though on March 28th, and again, I'm assuming that he had authority to do this, he granted your motion to reconsider, right?
He did, Judge.
So
He
what I want to know is, what is it that we can do for you today that you don't already have?
and you know, it's a shame that we couldn't have resolved it on well, not on the 28th, but the court date following the 28th. But to answer your first question, Judge, I don't believe the appeal was premature. And you, I mean, I can correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe I'm reading it wrong.
Well, but what is it you're looking for that you didn't already get?
Well, it at the point that the judge granted or indicated he was going to grant our motion, we believe that the court didn't have jurisdiction because the case was on appeal. To the best that I could find in Westlaw and you know my research, once a notice of appeal is filed, literally that moment, jurisdiction is taken from the trial court and put into the appellate court where the appeal resides, only as to matters of like. Scheduling and things like that remain in the trial court. And so any orders that were entered after the notice of appeal was filed were without jurisdiction, as best as I can tell from the case law. Now, and this is why we did ask to have the record supplemented, not only what to the record, to the report of proceedings, because if you look at the transcript from March 28th, we did acknowledge that the court was going to grant this, and what we wanted to do was we wanted to withdraw our appeal because we didn't want to create unnecessary work. And so, what we asked the judge to do is continue it for 2 weeks so we could do that. And so, it ended up getting continued to April 11th. The issue, though, is that we were after speaking to the opposing party, opposing counsel, we had concerns that if we were to withdraw the appeal, voluntarily withdraw the appeal midstream like that. And have the judge enter an order after 30 days from the default. We were concerned that she could bring an argument and say, "Well, that was without jurisdiction." The court's jurisdiction ended 30 days after the entry of the final order. They withdrew their appeal. Jurisdiction's over, and the case is over. And without an agreed order to revest the court with jurisdiction at that point, to the best that I could tell from my research, we might be putting our client in a position that, you know. She could come back and say, "No, there's no more jurisdiction," even if the court wanted to grant the motion.
So where are you in the trial court? You have a trial date, right?
We did have a trial date. It was stricken. I
It
believe
was. Okay.
opposing counsel did file a motion to strike the trial date because she believed that yes, that the case was on
Okay.
appeal, and so there was no. But
It,
we did
it.
bring it to the court's attention that we asked for an agreed order just to revest, so there weren't any jurisdictional issues, so it
Okay.
wasn't any question. But
What you're saying is layman serves, you were caught in a trick bag.
I really was, Judge, and to the other point of that question on we when the judge set the motion for a briefing schedule, we said, okay, fine, March 28th, fine, briefing schedule, sure. But then I went home and I read Illinois Supreme Court Rule 303, and I realized that in part two, A2, at the very end, it says, no request for reconsideration of a ruling on a post-judgment motion will toll the running of time within which to file a notice of appeal. And so I realized that I didn't have any more time. I didn't have time. If I committed to the motion to reconsider and the judge denied my motion to reconsider, now I'm dead in the water with no ability to appeal. And I didn't want that situation for my client. So
I just wanted to
for
be
those
clear on
reasons,
where things are in the trial court. So right now
yes,
you're on hold, basically.
on hold. Yes.
There is a status date in January, is there not, Mr. Tumanaro?
Yes, just status on the appeal, just to
Right.
see what, yes. And so moving on to our motion to vacate and the denial of the motion to vacate, we have sort of a two-part argument to this. The first issue that we took with the court's ruling on our motion to vacate, denying our motion to vacate, is that the judge said, if I could just have one moment. So the motion to vacate was heard on December 3rd of 2024, and what the judge said, he said that so if I, he said so if I do this, meaning grant my motion to vacate. If I do this, the wheels will fall off this entire call. So I understand your position, the position you're in. I know that you want me to vacate the default, but I'm not going to vacate that default. And at that point, the judge didn't have any, there wasn't any discussion of the details of why the appearance wasn't filed that led to the default. It was simply that the court cited to his court order. He said, your client had a copy of our court or my court order requiring him to file an appearance before the trial date. It wasn't done. The simple fact that it wasn't done means there was, and that's how, why I entered the default. And that's the only reason that I'm using to deny your motion to vacate. In addition to apparently he was concerned that if he does it for me, he'll have to do it for everybody on his call. And I understand that it's a small claims call. I do understand that, but was there a question? I'm sorry. Oh, I think I'm hearing myself from someone's microphone. Whittakus versus Electronic Co-op, which is a Fourth District case that I cite to, it's from 1960, but it says that a motion to vacate a default judgment under 1301 E has to be decided on the facts of each case, not on a hard, fast rule, case by case basis. That statement that the court made it seem like it wasn't a case by case basis, that it's a general rule that we're in small claims court. I don't grant these types of motions, not for you, not for anyone. If I do it for you, I'm going to have a problem with my call. And so I'm denying your motion. And so that's the first part, that we believe that it was an abuse of discretion to employ such a hard and fast rule in opposition of what's said in the Fourth District case of Whittakus. But additionally, the court didn't consider any of the relevant factors, whether there was due diligence in not filing the appearance, whether there's an existence of a meritorious defense, whether the penalties to the defendant for keeping this default judgment, and then the hardships on the parties and the plaintiff for vacating, in other words, making the plaintiff proceed to trial versus having the default judgment. The court didn't consider any of those things in issuing his ruling on our motion to vacate the default. He basically said that it was he, that the there was a failure to act. That failure to act caused the default, and because there was a failure to act, I'm refusing to vacate. And I found something very interesting in the Second District case of Rockford Housing Authority versus Donahue. The court in that case, they had a defendant in front of them who failed to file their appearance. And the court, the defendant showed up for trial but had failed to file their appearance. And the court defaulted them and said, you didn't file your appearance like I told you. And so we're entering default judgment. That case went on appeal. And on appeal, they said there was no other consideration of why that appearance wasn't filed or anything like that. It was just the simple fact that it wasn't filed. I'm entering default and I'm refusing to vacate the default judgment, even though there was a timely motion in that case. What the court said, though, is if the same failure in this is in deciding a 1301E motion to vacate the default, if the same failure to act that caused the default in the first place automatically justified the failure to vacate the default, Section 2-1301E would be meaningless. In other words, there would never be a situation where a default judgment was vacated because the judge could just say, well, I entered default because you didn't do this. You're asking me to vacate this, and well, I'm looking at it and you didn't do what I said, so no. And that undermines the whole purpose of 2-1301E. And so for all of those reasons, we believe that it, essentially defendant didn't get a fair shake, not at the default judgment stage and not at the motion to vacate the default stage. So we believe that there was an abuse of discretion not only to enter the default, but also to vacate a denial of our motion to vacate the default. So for those reasons, we would be asking to reverse the ruling of the trial court, both on the motion to vacate and the default judgment. I know I probably have some, I didn't time it, but if there's any other questions, let's.
Justice Peterson, you're muted.
I was just saying, I was saying you're out of time, but do you have it? Do Justice Anderson, Justice Davenport, do you have any questions?
None.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Miss, is it Gensen or Jensen?
Genson, thank you.
Okay. You may proceed.
Thank you. I'd like to just address a couple of the points that the defendant appellant has brought up. The first one was that there was no inquiry as to why he did not file an appearance. There still is no issue as to why he didn't file an appearance. And quite frankly, even when he hired an attorney, they didn't file an appearance until December. So that goes back to the his reference to the Rockford case. The Rockford case said he couldn't afford the filing fee. Here, there's no question. He was told in the order, which was very specific to this case, you have to do three things. You have to file an appearance, you have to exchange exhibits for the trial, and you have to show up. And all you did was show up. That's why there was a default that was entered. There was a question about whether there was a verification, whether verification by the attorney was good enough. Apparently it is. It's a fill in the blank form, a small claims complaint. It's found on C10. It says we, the undersigned, certify under penalties as provided by law pursuant to 735 ILCS 5/1-109 and the Supreme Court Rule 137 that the statements set forth in this instrument are true and correct. Yes, it looks like his attorney did file it with the attorney's signature, but the attorney's verifying that he has the that he's verifying that the statements are set forth in there.
No, he's certifying that the statements are set forth in there are true. Not that the statements are set forth therein, but that they are true and that he has personal knowledge thereof. So
Correct.
the question that I asked of the appellant was whether or not there had been any inquiry by the court at a prove-up as to what personal knowledge the attorney had. That was my question.
Well, if there was or if there wasn't, the verification states that he does have personal knowledge. Besides that, Winkler was in court at the time. So there could have been verification at that time anyway. Counsel appellant keeps on going on about, well, he didn't understand the order. He didn't get a copy of the order. It was very clear in the transcript. The court said, here's the order. You got to do these things. Pick up the order. He showed up to court. He showed up to court in April. He showed up to court in July. He showed up to court in October. Here's the court order. Did you comply with it? No, he didn't comply with it. There's no excuse for ignorance of the law. And besides it, we're not even dealing with whether he understood the law. We're dealing with did you or did you not comply with the court order? I told you to pick it up. I told you to read it. Did you do these things? Did you file an appearance? No. Did you exchange exhibits? No. He asked, the court asked, did you understand this? He said yes.
Ms. Genson, let me ask a question, if I may. One of the factors that influences a court is the discretion the court has on a motion to vacate is the relative hardships, and Mr. Tumminero brought that up as one of the factors. Can you tell me, since it wasn't addressed in the brief or addressed by the court, what hardships would the plaintiff had endured or suffered if the default had been vacated?
Additional attorney's fees to start with, a resolution of a claim that's a small small claims, it could have been resolved at the first time it sh they ever showed up at court.
No, I'm talking about if the default had been vacated, not the first time that they showed up in court. So I asked if the default had been vacated. So that presumes that you have proceeded through the time that the judgment had been entered, and now we are at the vacating of the default.
Okay, so you vacate the default, and now the proceedings go on. While the proceedings go on, he's still paying his attorney. He's still the litigation is still proceeding at a snail's pace for this type of case. It's just a small claims case. I mean, no, nobody wants to. Let me back up a little bit. Appellant had said, "Oh, well, it should be vacated because I've got a meritorious defense." That's all he said. He didn't say what his meritorious defense was. He just says, "Well, I've got one." That's not good enough. That's not ever good enough. You got
He
to tell me
didn't.
what
He
your
did say it, but
meritorious
he
defense.
didn't say it until the motion to reconsider.
Correct. And if you're going to file, if you've got to say you've got a meritorious defense, tell me what it is. Tell me what your facts are. Sign an affidavit saying this is my meritorious defense. There's no meritorious defense here that was known, and it certainly wasn't available to for the plaint for the plaintiff to know on the date of trial.
So the answer to my question was attorney's fees, correct?
Attorney's fees and the litigation going on
Okay, thank
when
you.
it shouldn't have. He's lost interest on a judgment. He's lost is the use of his $10,000. Sure, there's hardships, all for somebody who just shows up and is just tossing the court's orders aside, and not paying attention to any of them. I mean, how hard is it to file an appearance? Well, like I said, I mean, appellant didn't even file one until December, so apparently there's something going on with filing appearances. Appellant had stated that the order was entered based solely on a failure to file an appearance. And like I said, had mentioned, there were three things in that order. And so it wasn't just solely file, not the failure to file an appearance. Counsel had mentioned that there was the court was following a hard and fast rule. It is absolutely incorrect. It's not a hard and fast rule because there was an order that was entered that was tailored to this particular case. This particular case, do these things, and then we're going to go to trial on October 30th. And it didn't happen. That is not a hard and fast rule. That's a tailored order for this case. And the last thing I just want to mention is that I will agree with the appellant that the notice of appeal will stop the jurisdiction of the trial court. And after 30 days of a final judgment, there can't be any substantive orders changed because the trial court wouldn't have any jurisdiction anymore. So for all of those reasons, we ask that the court affirm the judgment.
Do you have any questions, Ms. Justice Davenport or Justice Anderson?
No, thank you.
No.
Okay. Then, Mr. Tumenaro, you have the opportunity in rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. Just briefly, there were several months between the time the order was entered requiring defendant to file his appearance and the trial date where he was defaulted. But there's a few points about that. Number one, although a few months had elapsed, he was given one chance to do it. There weren't multiple chances where there were multiple orders saying, "Sir, do this, or you're going to be defaulted." It was just a simple order that it was an order that was entered. It was spelled out in great detail. He needed to file an appearance, and he didn't do it. But he had that one chance, and then he was defaulted. So there weren't multiple chances. He was standing right in front of the court. It's not a situation where he missed court or he was, just simply tossing the order to the side. like flouting the judicial authority of the court. It was a simple matter of him being ignorant to the process, and he didn't realize that by failing to file an appearance or even following the court's order, he would be landing himself in this position. I don't even think he knew what a court order was. On the date he was defaulted, the judge said, "Do you have a copy of the order?" And I think the court actually had to spell out what a court order was because my client just did not know. And the court did have some other options available to it other than defaulting him while he was standing right there. They could have passed the case so he could go file an appearance and then come right back. And so, for those reasons, I still do submit that it was an abuse of discretion to fail to enter the default judgment and then to deny our motion to vacate. We didn't spell out the meritorious defense in the motion to vacate. One of the justices pointed out we did spell it out in our motion to reconsider, but we did not spell it out in the motion to vacate. It's not technically required that, but it is, we did plead it, but we just didn't spell it out in great detail in the motion to vacate. But it was there. And that's it. That's all I have to say, Judge. And we would ask that you find it in our favor. Thank you.
And do you still stand in the position you, I think, argued down at the trial court that the motion to reconsider, the denial of the motion to vacate, did not toll the time to file your appeal, that you had to file your appeal, and once that's done, that divests the trial court of jurisdiction?
I believe, yes, I stand on that position that we had we not filed the appeal at that point and then lost the motion to vacate, we would be dead in the water with that. We couldn't appeal at that point. The motion to reconsider didn't toll the time frame under 303A. And so we do stand on that position.
Justice Davenport, Justice Anderson, do you have any additional questions?
I have none. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. And we will take this matter under advisement and issue a decision in due course.